the future.
There are no people.
There are no people in the future.
No people at all.
There are no people in the future.
Where did all my people go?
There are no people in the future.
Let me try my people call.
Everybody, it is Wednesday, June 2nd, 2021. Welcome once again to the newest edition to Raging Chicken's collection of podcasts. It's the Wednesday show with Cyril Michalako, everybody. Yes, Cyril is a progressive columnist for the Bucks County Courier-Times and the Intelligencer. This show joins Out to Coop Live, our Monday evening interview show, and our Friday politics roundup in which Sean Kitchen and I break down the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. You can get all our shows by subscribing to our podcast on Podbeans, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. You should also make sure that you're signing up for Cyril's newsletter on Substack. That is cyrilmichalako.substack.com. You can hit the click, just the link right in our show notes, but it's cyrilmichalako.substack.com. Just look up Cyril there. You can get all his writing there in addition to his regular column. You'll get profiles of progressives in Pennsylvania, news roundups, and so much more. And you can support this show by becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month by going to patreon.com/allrcpress. That's patreon.com/rcpress. Your support has helped make today's show possible. So thank you. You can also help out the show by going over to our YouTube channel if you're not there already. And make sure you smash that subscribe button, like the stream for the show, and hit that little notification bell so you know every time that we go live. Make sure to join our Discord server, too. Yes, where you can continue the conversation all week long. Just click on the link in today's show notes to join our Discord server. And a special shout out to Jonathan Mann, who wrote our intro song, There Are No People in the Future. Check out all his great stuff on his YouTube page and follow him on Twitter at @SongADayMan with two N's. That's @SongADayMan on Twitter. On today's show, Cyril and I are talking free trade, fair trade, trade agreements like NAFTA, CAFTA, USMCA. It's the alphabet soup of globalization, everybody. Both of us were involved with organizing against corporate globalization in the late 1990s and early 2000s. And in many ways, that fight continues and becomes even more pressing as we confront challenges of climate change, deepening inequality, white supremacy, and rising authoritarianism. So, hey, man, good morning, Cyril.
Good morning. How's it going, Kevin?
Hey, pretty good. And just a note for everybody who's kind of watching us right now on YouTube and so on. You may have noticed that you're going to that during the show and during the live stream that you're going to see the video might kind of get a little crackly at times. But know that we're moved to this service in part because it'll allow us to have HD video that we'll kind of upload and afterwards. So I had a couple people just kind of ask me about that after last week's show, so I wanted to acknowledge it. But yes, to kind of we're working the kinks out and getting this rolling. But so Cyril, man, you know, we talked a little about this ahead of time, and you and I both kind of cut our teeth in certain ways in the global justice movement in the late 1990s and early 2000s. And it seems to me that, you know, questions of free trade, fair trade, all those issues that were kind of raised back then haven't really gone away. As a matter of fact, they seem to be heating up again.
No, I mean, absolutely. I mean, if we go back to like 2016, when President Trump was first elected, like trade was one of the major issues and was a reason why first Bernie Sanders was so popular, not only among Democratic voters, right, but among some Republican voters that ended up voting for Trump. And one of the reasons why they ended up going in that direction is because, like, Trump, you know, for all of his character flaws and political flaws, was able to kind of like tap into that kind of economic angst, if not rage, by working class Americans who have been shafted by both parties since 1994 in the passage of NAFTA. Now, even though Trump's kind of analysis of the trade agreements was kind of like upside down, you know, kind of blaming, it was a xenophobic, just kind of rants, blaming like Mexican or workers in developing countries for stealing our jobs rather than kind of giving a class analysis and how it's actually like U.S. corporations and their lackeys in Washington who are responsible for, you know, drafting these trade agreements that put corporate profits over, you know, human rights. You know, that was like a major issue in the election, and you know, Hillary Clinton didn't have a leg to stand on.
Right, exactly. You know, in many ways, Hillary Clinton was, you know, part of, like, you know, one of the kind of, say, you know, poster adults, not poster children, but poster adults of, you know, free trade, right? I mean, the Clinton administration was really kind of finished off the Reagan agenda when it came to free trade by being, the president that signed NAFTA into being. And it seems interesting that we see the first major revision of NAFTA is now done under a Trump administration, right? Yeah. Of course, he has to rename it and brand it and things like this as his own. But what was interesting about this, that trade agreement that that kind of was brought to the fore, is that, you know, many labor groups got behind this because they saw one of the complaints that had been, outstanding for the original NAFTA was that there was not really, you know, any labor protections or environmental protections with any teeth, right? And so those frustrations, I think you're right to point out, were kind of, you know, at least motivating a lot of voters in particular areas of the country during the last election. But, you know, it's also the kind of thing where we see the reason why, you know, you've had Trumka, basically, for AFL-CIO, getting on board with the USMCA, in part because they saw some strength in these labor conditions. And I think that, you know, we're at the point right now, we seem to be facing some of the first real tests of those teeth, particularly what we're seeing with some of the stuff that's happening down in Mexico, right?
Sure. I mean, I just want to say, like, this is frustrating that it happened under Trump because progressive Democrats have been railing against free trade for years, right? People like Sherrod Brown, senator in Ohio. But unfortunately, it was the kind of party leadership and, you know, the Democratic establishment that kind of kept them at arm's length. But yeah, like you were saying, now there's like a case that that's coming, that the U.S. is calling for based on a GM plant in Mexico where workers have been kind of pressured from voting for an independent union in the factory, right? So this is the first test of these new like enforcement mechanisms under the new US-Mexico Canada free trade agreement. You know, what we're seeing is that, like, you know, workers have been blocked allegedly from kind of electing this union. Ballots have been destroyed. Independent auditors haven't been allowed in to kind of count the vote. The one thing I will say that I think is, you know, pretty badass is that, you know, President Biden appointed Thea Lee as the lead of the Labor Department's Bureau of International Labor Affairs, right? So she's in charge of kind of enforcing these new mechanisms. And Thea Lee's just like, you know, for like trade geeks, she's a rock star. You know, she was like the chief international economist for the AFL-CIO. She was the president of the Economic Policy Institute, progressive think tank in Washington. So I'm really interested to see, you know, how this plays out, and two, you know, what she's able to accomplish in Washington under the Biden administration. And, you know, like we've both kind of said, and like what's been happening over the years, like, you know, free trade isn't kind of, you know, even within the Republican Party, free trade isn't accepted doctrine anymore. And it's a huge moment.
Well, you know, look, I don't want to get us too far afield here, but one of the things, this is a perfect example of what, you know, people like David Dayen from the American Prospect have been paying attention to, saying, okay, look, there's the one hand, on the surface, there's some aspects of the Biden administration that seem to be fairly mainstream Democrat, right? Even though, you know, he's been very pro-labor, at least in his rhetoric from the get-go. But what they've been paying a lot of attention to are these appointments. Right. I mean, and because that's where, in a sense, the rubber hits the road. That's where the interpretation and the forcefulness about whether or not these provisions are going to be enforced. Right. So when, for example, Marty Walsh was chosen as the Secretary of Labor. Right. He's a former labor guy. Right. And now you have, like, you know, again, just like you're saying, you've got, you know, former kind of lead economist in the, you know, AFL-CIO is actually running these trade, you know, these trade policy stuff around, well, these particular provisions, that's huge, right? Because you know what they're going to bring. Because, and but the flip side of that, of course, is that, you know, if you have a different administration, right, that switches off who's there, right, we could kind of see a lax in those on those provisions. But at least this is first, we're going to be able to test the staying power of these provisions and strengthening of labor protections under the UMCA. USMCA.
No, yeah, I mean, absolutely, and it's about time. We've had, you know, we've had decades to kind of look at and examine and see with our own eyes that these false promises of free trade. I mean, look what NAFTA did. It gutted the U.S. manufacturing base, right? We've lost, you know, estimates around like a million, if not more, jobs just from manufacturing jobs, good paying,
exactly,
like middle class, working class jobs with benefits where you could raise a family and have a good life. They just got all sucked down to Mexico. And with Mexico, the workers, it's not improving their quality of life. Right?
Which was one of the promises, right? The idea was that eventually using this idea that eventually the quality of life will improve and therefore this stuff, you know, the loss of American jobs will begin to shake out, right? But of course that's not what happens, right? Unless you have strong kind of like anti-capitalist regulations, that's not what's going to happen.
No, absolutely. And it didn't. You know, there's 20, you know, back in 2014, like the Center for Economic Policy Research Institute put out a report kind of like tracking NAFTA's impact on Mexico. And, you know, in 2014, there was 20.5 million more Mexicans living in poverty than there were in 1994. And wages essentially stayed the same. Any kind of like rise in wages were just very nominal. So they didn't have, you know, any kind of real impact of kind of like lifting these people out of poverty. And we see that across the board, right? You know, with like, you know, 1994, you had NAFTA, and then, you know, the WTO, the normalization of kind of the neoliberalization of kind of like trade and the global economy. It's done absolutely nothing to alleviate global poverty and actually, it's exacerbated global inequality. You know, so like in 2018, Oxfam put out their report, and they were able to see that the richest 1% in the world have as much wealth as 6.9 billion people, right?
Right.
And then, you know, in the U.S., and this is something like Bernie Sanders pointed out, you know, Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, and Warren Buffett have as much wealth as the bottom half of the U.S. population combined, right?
Right, and I think it's really important to see these, you know, all of those things together, what you've just said, as directly connected, right, to this kind of neoliberalization of international trade or global trade, right? Because on the one hand, you also saw, you know, again, a complete disruption. You know, you talk about Silicon Valley and the tech world always loves to talk about disruptive technologies. But really, that process had really already been set in motion, right, by deals like this, right, where you're disrupting entire economies, entire sectors, entire communities, right, as a way of kind of having these givebacks to global corporate power. I mean, I've told this story before on Out to Coop, but I remember I was at a steelworker forum in Reading years ago, right before the lead up to the FTAA negotiations, Free Trade Area of the Americas down in Miami. And there was a panel of local legislators and statewide legislators who were there. There's some trade representatives that were at this kind of community forum. And they were talking about the loss of manufacturing jobs. And they started talking about, you know, China's manipulation of monetary policy and how China was doing this, And I started getting a little upset. So I went over there and I asked a question and I basically said, look, I understand why you're talking to me, pointing to the monetary policy in China and all this stuff. But what about the corporations? Right. What about the legislation that unleashed these corporations? These are quote unquote American corporations like Coca-Cola. Like, you know, I was like naming off these companies. I said, what do we do to rein them in? And literally to a person on the stage, they were all kind of shrugged. Right. Because they recognized that they had let the cat out of the bag. They had virtually no control over kind of the accumulation of capital and what was happening at the global level.
No, like blaming China is kind of like castigating a hitman for joining the mafia, right? It's just like, it's the system that's the problem.
Right, that's exactly it. And this is why, you know, one of the things that, you know, you pointed to about the election with Trump, even with Bernie Sanders, and now even now to the Biden administration to a certain degree, is like on the one hand, we see this loosening of this kind of neoliberal order, right? But there's also these tinges of nationalism, right, that are kind of threaded through all of this, right? You know, we saw this even in the response to the pandemic, right? That America first, and then we can go and do this other stuff. And there's some of that discourse that's kind of coming out now in terms of these, we want to call it emerging trade regime. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that there's these two things going on. On the one hand, you people walking away from this, you know, gospel, you know, like being wedded to the dogma of free trade. And on the other hand, trying to work out, well, like, how do we do this kind of global, you know, new global structure, or do we just revert back to a kind of a nationalism? And I see, you know, what's happened to the Biden administration. On the one hand, you've got, you know, wanting to have a minimum corporate tax, global corporate tax, right? Mm-hmm. Which speaks to these international structures. And then at the same time, we saw at the hearings I'm spacing her name, Catherine Tai, right? Her confirmation hearings as for the office of the U.S. Trade Representative, who she was confirmed 98-0 on Monday. She's talking very much about protecting American workers, right? Which is totally understandable, right? But so you kind of see these tensions going on, and it makes it a really dynamic moment, I think.
No, absolutely, and I think that like would be like one critique of one part of the kind of like anti or ultra-globalization movement or anti-free trade movement in the US, especially with the unions, is they did latch on to this, not all, but largely like this economic nationalism, like you were saying, and like pushing like Buy American. But the way, you know, the way to protect American workers is to protect workers around the globe.
Exactly.
Because it just kind of, when you create a level playing field, you cease this kind of like race to the bottom where like corporations will just kind of like outsource from country to country, constantly looking for like the weakest labor and environmental standards so that they can kind of like maximize their profits. And, you know, what we need, if we're going to like fight like global capitalism, like we need like a global movement, right?
Exactly.
To stand up against them.
Well, that's, you know, that's what makes it, you know, there's this other case too as well, which kind of follows on the GM case in Mexico, which is that one, the Triodex, right, firm, right, where you're, this is a kind of another complaint. This is one where there's an accusation that Mexican factories are kind of, you know, abusing labor and violating all sorts of provisions in this contract. Triodex, by the way, I found this extraordinarily interesting, is a subsidiary of a Philadelphia-based Cardone Industries. So we've got a Pennsylvania connection right here, folks. But what was fascinating about this, right, and was fascinating in that, you know, we're looking at this ahead of time. There was an article that came out in the Washington Post. Was that right? Yeah, it says this was reporting from Anna Swanson, right? You know, that one says in Washington, free trade is no longer gospel. What was fascinating for me in this is that you had quoted labor leaders from, say, SEIU, from the Teamsters, from AFL-CIO, who were basically making the same case that you were just making about the need to ensure that we're protecting workers everywhere if we're going to be able to defend American workers. So seeing that, even that push in the language and the discourse when it comes to these trade issues.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. There's just, the one thing that's promising, like you said, about like the Biden administration is like, you know, they are focusing on like workers' rights. And if they do it in the correct way, then that's a good thing. But they're also like not pushing new trade agreements. And that's huge because all the existing trade agreements that we have are completely flawed, right? And while there's been improvements to what was NAFTA, with maybe with slightly stronger labor provisions, as well as there's an investor state dispute settlement mechanisms in all of these trade agreements that actually allow like companies to sue countries for labor and environmental laws that they deem are like barriers to profits, right? So, like, for example, like, you know, under NAFTA, Mexico was forced to pay a California-based company over $15 million because the company was denied a construction permit to build a toxic waste site in an area designated as an ecological preserve. This was the best we could do. Like, this was what both Democrats and Republicans thought was a good idea when kind of crafting this NAFTA model for like trade agreements.
Right.
So we have to go through like everything that we've done, right, in the past, and just kind of fix them. And that's just one step.
Well, you know, let me just say, just before anybody, you know, says, well, you know, Mexico has to deal with these things, blah, blah, blah. Let's just be clear. These trade agreements, these secret tribunals, which would, you know, corporate tribunals, which would decide about whether there's been an infraction or not, whether or not it's hurt the companies, right, for their future capital profits, was something that also came back to, you know, to haunt folks in the U.S. I mean, there were in California, if you remember this one, and this is back in like 2012 or something, there were these additives that were to gasoline, right, that was called MTBE, right, which they found that was cancerous and that was toxic, right? And so California passed legislation banning this additive, right, from gasoline. Right. And the company who basically said, you can't do that. Right. Because that if you pass that law, that's going to interfere with our future profits. So California actually came back and rolled back that legislation. Right. In order so that the state of California would not have to pay, or the federal government would not have to pay. Right. The WTO and the company for the loss of future profits. I mean, this was the kind of stuff that got rolled out like shortly after NAFTA kind of got rolling, too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I just like, unfortunately, I don't think like the media did a great job of kind of like highlighting these, you know, these attacks on democracy. Right. I mean, that's what it is. Like these free trade agreements just did anything possible to kind of undermine democracy, undermine human rights, labor rights, and environmental protections. But we're finding ourselves in a moment now where maybe that can swing, you know, but again, you know, with everything, political, like we need organizing, right? We need not only just protests, but like education, different types of like mobilizations, and we need to put like pressure on lawmakers, especially like serious, intense pressure on the Biden administration, because there's an opening.
Right.
You know, he is sympathetic, at least that though these are, you know, with people like Thea Lee and Ty, like this is what we're seeing. It's like putting like decent, good people in the right places to actually make changes that'll have impacts on not only American workers' lives, but Mexican workers' lives and around the globe.
Absolutely. So this is one of the things I want to, you know, as this is one of these things where we're going to be coming back to these issues, right? This is one of the, you know, the expansions of the Wednesday show here that we're obviously going to get to talk about, see what Cyril's working on in kind of in just a minute. But we'll, you know, we'll follow up when he has a column that kind of comes out. We'll talk a little about the column. But we're going to continue to bring in kind of additional issues. And then down the road, we're also going to be bringing in some interviews and playing around with this format too as well to help kind of build out this platform here too as well. One of the things I do want to add before we kind of talk about what you got in the hopper right now is that the one difference I think that we have now as these issues of trade are kind of coming back to the fore again is that I think the left, the progressive left at least, is better organized and has a better understanding of power than it did, say, back in 1990 or 2000. And so, like, and I'm talking about the fact that you've got, you know, organizing around local, like your state representatives, not just kind of like, you know, a move on emails to the Biden administration, but actually showing up at the offices of your representatives. And I do think that, you know, I mean, not to always bring it back to Bucks County here, but you got, say, Brian Fitzpatrick, Fitzpatrick, who's right, you know, here in Bucks County, right? You know, people argue, well, he's a moderate, he's not, but go back and forth on that. But the fact of the matter is, if you want to actually kind of ensure that you're going to have strong policy that is going to be enacted at the federal level, right? That means getting more Republicans out of office, right? And this issue of trade, I think, is one of these ones that allows us to really kind of hold legislators' feet to the fire, right? By saying, okay, let's talk about strong protections. And I, you know, we're not going to have time to really talk about this. Kay Aronoff had an amazing piece that just came out, just dropped in these times, called The Perils of an America First Climate Policy, which raises this question about, you know, we really are going to need, right, to think about these kind of global systems and structures and begin enacting them. This trade is one of them. And I think that that's all, you know, one of these organizing principles that we can really get around and actually hold our legislators' feet to the fire.
No, you know, absolutely. And we have to, because, you know, Fitzpatrick's brother was one of the deciding votes on CAFTA. Right?
Exactly.
I mean, even back then, which I think was 2006, you could see the tide was turning, because CAFTA only passed by two votes in the House, right? During the Bush administration. So, you know, I'm just hoping that the Democratic Party locally is coming close to identifying some candidates, and some candidates are stepping up that can kind of speak to these issues, right? And kind of present a kind of progressive populist platform that doesn't kind of shrink into economic nationalism, but engages with the world and kind of shows how we need global solidarity in order to kind of create a new just, fair, and sustainable, like, economic global order.
I'm so glad you just said that about Fitzpatrick being the decided to vote on CAFTA, because I remember when shortly after I had moved to the area, I remember seeing these, you know, during election time, there's these giant 8x10 sheets of plywood that come out to say, like, farmers for Fitzpatrick. I remember at one point getting so frustrated around these votes and what was going on. I rolled out my window in my car. I was like, but NAFTA, you know, because, of course, these trade agreements have decimated American farmers in so many ways. Right. Uh-huh. And so, you know, and I think about, you know, breaking those coalitions and looking at those key points of pressure. This is one of them. Right. If we want to kind of ensure that you're protecting, say, family farms or kind of even kind of mid-sized farming, if you want to make sure that you're defending local manufacture. Right. This is, you know, these trade issues matter. And I think that's going to be really interesting to see some of the organizing of this moving forward.
Yeah, it's definitely something to follow.
Cool. So, hey, before we head out, let's hear a little bit about what you're working on. What are some of the stuff you got working on, got in the hopper, or paying attention to these days?
Sure. So I have a column coming out on Thursday, and this will be about infrastructure in Pennsylvania, but specifically with, like, Pennsylvania, like, public transit. Act 89, which was actually signed by Governor Tom Corbett. It was like a bipartisan legislation for, like, long-term financing of public
We should
transit.
Do a show just on Corbett someday. Just like, I mean, just, I don't want to get us far off. Anyways, go ahead.
Where are they now? It's about why we need to, because that sunsets next year, right? So I kind of write about why it's an important environmental justice issue, right? Economic justice issue. And I'm kind of, like, urging folks to contact their local state lawmakers, because this is something where, but it's also something where, like, workers and communities of color are disproportionately impacted by this issue. So hopefully it gets a good response, right? And kind of, like, spurs people into action. That's what I'm, you know, that's the whole idea of the column, right?
Right.
Just to be a clear progressive voice, but to kind of, like, offer, like, solutions and actions so people can actually kind of, like, get engaged as, you know, Bucks County's progressive movement continues to grow and just kind of shake things up.
Excellent. Love to see it. And it's also kind of useful to point out, too, as well, you've got some Democratic legislators, particularly those folks on the progressive end of the end of it, really looking at ways of tying some of this potential infrastructure money that's coming from federal to specific projects that would do the kind of things that you're talking about. Right. So not allow the Pennsylvania Republican Party just to kind of do whatever the hell they want and call infrastructure, I don't know, like, you know, putting more whiskey in their cabinets or something. I don't know.
Absolutely. And the federal money is important, and that'll give us like a one-time, shot in the arm, which could have like a huge impact. But I'm just wondering, like, is Harrisburg capable, right, of like passing legislation? Because you have like this toxic, partisanship with the Republicans. They're such extremists. Like I could see them potentially just saying like, screw it, like wolf's a lame duck. We don't want to pass anything, right? We don't care who it impacts, even our own constituents, because we know no matter what. In most cases, in some of these gerrymandered districts, they're kind of safe.
Yeah, well, I'm going to give the last word to a comment that came in on YouTube from Ross. It says, good stuff. As an engineer since 1980, I've been laid off 5 times due to imports. It's coming back. U.S. goods manufacturing will be a big opportunity for here in Upper Bucks County. So can't think of a better way to close out the show today, Ross. Thank you for the comments. Appreciate it. And then Sean just kicks in. See, now when they start rolling. Republicans doing nothing is the best thing for all of Pennsylvania. Appreciate the comments and thoughts. So any closing thoughts before we head off into the week?
No, that's about it. I'm excited about the new show that we're doing. I'm excited about us talking about some of these kind of like global issues and highlighting, both the good and the bad about what's happening around the world. Because this is kind of like an old saying, but it's just about like thinking globally and acting locally, right? So it's just like understanding what's happening in the world and applying that here where we can kind of make a difference and then have that kind of project outward.
100%. And in future shows, Cyril and I have been talking about kind of really kind of bringing in kind of questions on racial justice, kind of looking at the impact of what's happening, impact on, say, women's rights, especially the attack at home and the attack globally. And kind of, again, bringing these issues on the kind of quote-unquote off weeks, right, when Cyril doesn't have a column that's out there, and to bring in some interviews here too as well. So I'm going to give everybody just a little quick sneak peek, just so you know, is that if you've been listening to the show all through today, you'll know I'll give you a little heads up. I'll talk more about this on the show on Friday, on our regular Friday news roundup. But I've got some two on Out to Coop Live on Mondays at 7 p.m. I got some two fantastic interviews coming up in 2 weeks. I've got sorry. Sorry, I got something caught in my throat right there. Cory Doctorow is going to be coming on the show. Cory Doctorow is an author, and he's written, kind of dozens and dozens of books. And his most recent book, How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism, is something we're going to be talking about, as well as some of his young adult fiction that deals with hackers and surveillance stuff. And then the week following that, we've got Kadita Kenner coming on for the executive director for the New Pennsylvania Project. So some great shows coming up this Monday at 7 p.m. We've still got that up in the air, but we'll have some announcements on that one cleared up on Friday. So Cyril, man, I can't wait to check out the column this week. And here's keep up the fight, and we'll see you again next Wednesday.
Thanks, Kevin. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, here we go. So this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. Thank you all for kind of tuning in today. Make sure before you leave our YouTube stream, make sure you hit that subscribe button, make sure you like the stream, and make sure you hit that notification bell so you know every time we go live. We will be back next Wednesday with another Wednesday show. We hope to see you Friday next Monday. See ya!